Conspiracy theories have always existed at the fringes of our public conversations, but in recent years they've become part of mainstream politics. Charges of a rigged presidential election, fake news reports, and allegations that former President Obama was born outside of the U.S. have all made the headlines, and they've had a lot of staying power as well. A lot of those have been put forth by candidate and now president Donald Trump. Here he is last year alleging that the FBI had planted spies in his campaign staff.
A lot of people are saying they had spies in my campaign. If they had spies in my campaign, that would be a disgrace to this country. That would be one of the biggest insults that anyone's ever seen, and it would be very illegal.
Our next guest says statements like that are part of a new type of conspiracy theory, one that dispenses with any kind of evidence and, she says, threatens our democratic institutions. Nancy Rosenblum is a professor emerita of ethics and politics and government at Harvard University. She's co-author of the book, A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
I'm happy to be here, Judith.
Can you talk a little bit about what makes conspiratorial thinking today different than it has been in the past?
Yes. Well, one thing, of course, is that conspiracism is coming today right from the Oval Office, from the halls of power, and being assented to by all kinds of elected officials and administrative officials and so on. So that's a new thing. But in terms of what makes the new conspiracism new qualitatively, it's a decoupling of two things we think go together. Conspiracy on the one hand and theory on the other. Your listeners will know what a real conspiracy theory is. Think of the conspiracy theories about 9/11 and who really took down the World Trade Center, or conspiracy theories about John F. Kennedy's assassination. These theories are like research. They involve detective work. They're an exhaustive accumulation of evidence and dots and patterns, all leading the same way to the same sort of outcome that a conspiracy was involved. They're a lot of work, and they reason in a way that we understand reasoning to proceed with evidence and argument. The new conspiracism, and we see it in the, we hear it in the little bit of clip that you played. The new conspiracism is conspiracy without the theory. It takes the form of sheer assertion without any evidence or argument. Or it takes the form, I'm just asking questions. I really want to know more. I can tell you my first experience with this, when I was really sort of smacked in the head by it, and it's what led me to want to write this book, was 2 days after President Trump's inauguration. He had claimed that he had the biggest inaugural crowd ever, bigger than President Obama's or any other. And when the National Park Service published, as they always do after inaugurations, photographs of his inaugural crowd, and it turned out to be much more modest than he had claimed, President Trump said the National Park Service doctored the photographs. This is a conspiracy theory. People in this office, civil servants, were doctoring photographs in order to bring him down. And it was the beginning for me, and perhaps for some others, of the notion that conspiracism today is just sheer assertion, not argument.
And you talk about these classical conspiracy theories. You just said they involve a lot of research, and there's something about having a goal of exposing something in the name of truth. But in this book, you write that the new conspiracy theorizing tries to delegitimize our democratic institutions and knowledge producers. Do we have a sense of why that's so important for the people who are spreading these new type of conspiracy theories?
Well, that's a complicated question, but a very good one. I think that there are two main effects of this kind of conspiracism that's sheer assertion without evidence or argument. One is that it's very disorienting for us. When Trump says that the National Park Service doctored the photographs, it's a sort of assault on our common sense. It's an assault on what it means to know something. We can't know something without having arguments and evidence. So the first consequence, I think, and perhaps your listeners have experienced this themselves, is a kind of almost wild disorientation. It's an assault on common sense. But what's also going on, and the National Park Service, again, is a good small example of it, is what we call the delegitimation of very important democratic institutions. And by delegitimation, it's not just mistrust or skepticism about these institutions. It really is saying that these institutions no longer have authority. They have no meaning. They have no value. They have no authority over us. They have no claim to our confidence, not even a claim to our compliance. And again, the National Park Service is just a tiny little example of it. So we see that this new conspiracism attacks, for one thing, just about every knowledge-producing institution involved in government, whether it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the National Intelligence Agencies or the FBI or the departments that deal with the science of climate change. All of them are attacked in vicious ways without any evidence, with the implication that they are creating bogus evidence, bogus information for some nefarious purpose.
Nancy Rosenblum is a professor emerita of ethics in politics and government at Harvard University. She's co-author of the book, A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. And let's take a call at 800-642-1234. Jean in Richland Center is up. Hi, Jean.
Howdy. My question remarks to the soundbite at the beginning. I thought in the Mueller report that, not Mueller himself, but the other gentleman sat there and said that there was evidence to that the FBI was actually monitoring the Trump campaign and also actually sent an undercover agent to Russia to meet with his son, if I remember correctly, on C-SPAN. Remember watching that. What about that?
All right. Thanks for that call, Gene. And Nancy, is there some truth in that assertion that the president made and others have made as well?
Yes, but the question is how we characterize it. If we characterize collecting information by the intelligence agencies of government as spying, we're suggesting that there is some nefarious purpose. We're suggesting that there's a plot. We're suggesting that they are involved in something like a coup against a president. Whereas if we think that the FBI initiated certain kinds of surveillance on two people initially connected rather transcendentally to the Trump campaign, that they initiated this according to all kinds of formal procedures, including getting a FISA warrant, and that their reason for doing so was national security concerns. They were concerned about erratic and incomprehensible relationships between these two people and the Russians, then it's not spying. Then it's our intelligence agencies taking care of national security. So the characterization matters. And the characterization spying, which is what Trump and his allies put on it, and what for that matter, Attorney General Barr said in a congressional hearing. He said, spying, I'm going to be looking into it. And he is looking into it. And we'll see whether the report that comes out of the Attorney General's office, if there is one, is a sort of conspiracist assertion of spying, or whether there's evidence that makes sense to us.
Thanks for that call. And Nancy, as we said, the title of your book is A Lot of People Are Saying. Why is it important for these theories and the people who are promulgating them to have the perception of widespread approval?
Very good question. I said that these are not conspiracy theories. That is, the claims are made, like the election is rigged, without evidence or argument. So what validates them? And what validates them in the minds of those who accept these things is precisely a lot of people are saying. What validates them is that there is assent and repetition, repetition and assent, repetition by more and more people. And we see why social media plays an important role in all of this. Because when social media spreads conspiracy claims and people repeat them and share them and like them and post them, you actually get a measure of the fact that a lot of people really are saying these things. And then the question becomes, what is it that people who accept these conspiracist claims and validate them by repeating them and assenting them and so on think these conspiracy claims really are? And here things get sort of politically interesting, I think, because the phrase we use to describe people's adoption of these conspiracy claims is that they're true enough. That is, they may even be true in all their details. They may not even be true in any of their facts. What's true for the people who were sent to them is that they correspond to their own political identity, to their political hatreds and their political affiliations. And by liking and sharing and repeating and adopting them, they are, identifying and affiliating with others who also do. So they, it becomes a kind of political participation, and the facts are not what's important. What's important is the animus underlying them. Shall I give you an example?
Certainly, please.
Your listeners probably have heard of the conspiracy claim Pizzagate. This is the notion that Hillary Clinton and John Podesta were running a child sex trafficking ring out of the basement of a pizza parlor outside of Washington, D.C. And it turns out that this is clearly false. There wasn't even a basement, although several people went on the suspicion that there was to try to rescue the children and shot up the place or set fire to the place. But the question is, people who spread this Pizzagate story, do they really think, even now, after all of the investigation, that Hillary Clinton is running a child trafficking ring out of the basement of a pizza parlor? I think they don't, or they don't have to. The story is true enough in the sense that Hillary Clinton does horrible things. She's an evil person. And so it's true enough that she could be doing this kind of a sexual perversion, subversion.
We're talking with Nancy Rosenblum, a professor emerita at Harvard University and co-author of the book A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that these types of conspiracy theories in our mainstream politics are worrisome? What impact do you think they've had on our political conversations? And why do you think they've become so common? How do you respond if you hear a baseless statement or see it on social media, and how do you address it with the person who's posted it? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Nancy Rosenblum. She's co-author of a new book, A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. And let's go to our callers. Brittany in Madison is up. Hi, Brittany.
Hello. I was curious if there is any conspiracy theories in the past that had turned out to be true in order to fuel this beliefs and things that are trying to break down our democracy.
Thanks for that, Brittany. And that was actually something, Nancy, that I wanted to bring up. Does that muddy the waters when there are some that might have at least a kernel of truth, if not more, to them?
That's a wonderful question. And I'm glad you both asked it. Conspiracy theories come in all kinds. Sometimes they're false. Sometimes they're a mix. And sometimes they're true. The fact of a conspiracy theory doesn't mean that it's made up and untrue. And so the example that we like to give, because it's such an authoritative example of a conspiracy theory that we all imagine is true, we all think is true, is the Declaration of Independence. If you read the Declaration of Independence, you'll see that what the colonists were doing, they set out a whole list of grievances against the crown and the king's ministers and the colonial governors. And this list of grievances, they said, add up to a pattern of tyranny against the United States. And that the only solution, the only response to this pattern of tyranny was revolution and independence from Britain. The Declaration of Independence, go home and read it, is a conspiracy theory. And there are lots of other conspiracy theories that are true. During the progressive era in the United States, they called it muckraking. They looked into the connection between smoke-filled rooms and bad corrupt politics and corporations and monopolies of corporations. And they revealed all of these things. And the result of this was all kinds of progressive democratic changes in the United States, things like the referendum and the initiative and the direct election of certain officials and so on. So there are many conspiracy theories that are true. Think of the cover-up of Flint, Michigan, of the water, you know, the polluted water in Flint, Michigan. This was a cover-up. And the people who worked very hard as detectives in both the state and federal governments uncovered this conspiracy in a conspiracy theory. So conspiracy theories can be true or false. And what matters is whether we accept the evidence and the argument over time.
Nancy, one of the things that I found most interesting in your book is it kind of makes our tendency to believe these things a little more human, that sometimes we are drawn to conspiracy theories because we are trying to make sense of proportion. So, for instance, beliefs that the 9/11 tragedy could not have been the actions of just those 12 men, or that the assassination of John F. Kennedy could not have been the action of one man, trying to make sense of these senseless acts.
Exactly right. You can say that conspiracy theory wants the world to be, and insists that the world must be, more logical and coherent than it really is. Conspiracy theorists don't accept that things can be accidents. They don't accept that things can be unintended consequences. They always have to see a human agent with a real determined plot that he or she is able to execute to perfection. And your point about proportionality is exactly right. I mean, conspiracy theorists cannot accept that John F. Kennedy was killed by a single lone gunman. They cannot accept that the towers in 9/11 were taken down by 19 men plotting in some remote corner of Afghanistan. It's disproportionate. There has to be a sort of equilibrium between cause and effect.
Let's go back to the phones, and Neil in Madison is up. Hi, Neil.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think I disagree with your guest slightly on the idea that this sort of conspiracism is new. Especially with President Trump, it always impressed me that what he was doing looked just like what Joseph McCarthy did in the 1950s. And if you consider that Roy Cohn was Joseph McCarthy's chief counsel and then was later lawyer to Trump Sr., you get that whole playbook for him. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil. And Nancy, Neil saying that there is actually more of a through line on this than perhaps we've been saying.
I appreciate that comment very much, and I understand where the question is coming from. I would persist in saying that there's a difference, even from the McCarthy era, in two respects. One is, although it's true that Joseph McCarthy himself waved a piece of paper that was a blank paper saying, I have the names of the communist infiltrators. And in a sense, that's like President Trump just making a claim without any evidence. What was going on at the time really was a full-scale implication of the agencies of government in trying to ferret out communists, not only in the movie industry or in famous places, but in elementary schools and high schools and in every kind of workplace. So it was a sort of concerted national investigative effort triggered by fear. And that's the other difference that I would point to. The era of McCarthyism really was an era of national fear against a Russian regime that we thought was a real military enemy of the United States. And this is not to excuse McCarthyism or that kind of conspiracism, but it is to say that the climate in which that witch hunt, and it really was a witch hunt, a massive national witch hunt, the climate in which that witch hunt was carried on was a different climate than today. I think we see attempts to make the climate today one of national fear. That is to say, for example, that the immigrants coming across the border are an invasion, right? That they are bringing criminality, that the Democrats are luring them in order to get them to vote, and so on and so forth. So fear is monger, but it's not hardly along the dimension of the Cold War.
And Nancy, before we let you go, is there a danger in ignoring these conspiracy theories when they show up, or is it better to not give them the oxygen, perhaps, to continue growing? What as a nation, as individuals, is the best approach?
Political psychologists who study this are divided on that question, Judith. Some say that to repeat them, even if it's to repeat them in order to rebut them, just gives them oxygen and they spread. And others say, no, you know, fact-checking and challenge and so on and so forth is helpful. I think, first of all, nobody is going to dissuade the conspiracists themselves. So your audience is really the audience of ordinary citizens who are baffled and disoriented and feel whipped about. And to speak truth to conspiracy is helpful to them. It's also, I think, a moral obligation, frankly. It's a moral obligation for us to call these things out and to insist that the president show that the National Park Service doctored photographs in order to delegitimize him.
Nancy, before we let you go briefly, is this a U.S. Phenomenon or does this happen in other countries as well?
Yeah, I'm asked that, and I ask colleagues from other places that all the time. It seems conspiracy theory is everywhere. Especially, actually, in non-democratic regimes, when the government is non-transparent, people invent conspiracies to try to figure out what's going on. But I think this particular thing, that is the assertion, the sheer assertion without evidence, the conspiracy without the theory, for the moment at least, seems to be peculiarly.
That was Nancy Rosenblum. She's professor emerita of ethics and politics and government at Harvard University. She's the co-author of the new book, A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy.